Welcome to the Aeolian Impromptu. I'm your host, Maya Barsak. Today, my guest is composer and performance artist Teresa Wong. Starting off with a few of her compositions, we're going to start with a solo cello improvisation, followed by a piece entitled To Burst to Bloom, Poem 1. Starting off with a couple compositions by Teresa Wong, a solo improvisation for cello, followed by To Burst to Bloom Poet One, which features Yara Voices and Teresa Wong. Now we're going to turn to a short interview I had with Teresa and her studio in Berkeley, California. Greetings, Teresa.
Hello. Good morning. Good evening to you.
Yes, we are in different time zones. You are in Berkeley, California right now. Is that correct?
That's right.
Is that home base?
Yes, that's home base. And I've been here, well, in Berkeley since about 2007 or so, but I've been in the Bay Area for many years. I grew up more or less here. So yeah, it's home base right now.
So you grew up in the Bay Area or you grew up elsewhere?
Well, I grew up in upstate New York until the age of 10. And then I moved with my family to the Bay Area because my dad had gotten a job out here. And in between, I'd also lived for a total of about 4 years in Europe. And so 2003 was the year I came back to the Bay Area and have been more or less based here since then.
Okay. And how did you get involved in new music, or shall we say, how did you become a composer and performance artist?
Yeah, so through a very windy path, I would say. I studied classical music growing up very intensely, actually mostly piano. That was my main instrument, cello as my secondary. And when I went to college, I wanted to kind of take a break and see what else was out there and, you know, explore different interests. And I eventually ended up studying design, mostly product design, which is sort of a combination of mechanical engineering and art. So for almost 10 years, I stopped playing and didn't really engage that much in music. And through the years of working, I had received a fellowship to work in Italy at a center called Fabrica in Treviso as a designer. And I would say in that period of time, I was first exposed to improvised music through concerts in Venice and through visiting artists who came to Fabrica because there was actually a music department there. So it was that kind of point in time where I discovered the whole world of experimental music, which was really, really exciting to me because I had sort of been running up against a wall with design as far as like feeling it was really right for me. And since music had always been my first love and sort of biggest passion, I realized there was this whole world of creative people making music in the way that I was experiencing as a designer of, you know, creative thinking, of conceptual thinking, playing with materials, you know, putting different media together, exploring just wacky ideas. And so sort of a light bulb went off. And that's when I began, you know, digging into what that meant, what that could be. So that was about 2001. Yeah.
So if I hear you correctly, you were a conceptual artist, visual artist, design artist that always had an affinity and a calling, music through the piano and cello. That led to being in Italy and then meeting all these various people. And that curiosity led you to becoming a performance artist and following your muses that way.
Yeah, I would. That's pretty much right. I wouldn't maybe say that I was a conceptual artist back then. I would consider myself a designer. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was, you know, I was sort of brought up in a situation in my family. Being a daughter of immigrants, I feel a lot of my experience was about, you know, doing something practical, doing something, a profession that would guarantee you some kind of stability, of course. And so, you know, the world of art, the world of pure art was sort of like forbidden. And I feel like the designer was like an okay path to follow. And yet The experience of being in Italy also exposed me to a lot of conceptual artists. Actually, that was one of the biggest influences of meeting people like Lawrence Wiener or Joseph Kosuth, where, you know, you think this person like makes his life out of writing text on the sidewalk, you know, and and there's this whole world around it, and there's a validation for it, and it seems so meaningless from the outside, and yet it means the world, and it really moved me, and I felt like slowly there was this, you know, validation for going out there and doing things that were just purely artistic, and yet realizing too there's a great quote unquote need, you know, like in design you think a lot about need finding and what's the purpose of something. So it's just that the purpose shifts from being perhaps practical and you know, rational to something that serves other needs that we have, that whatever you can philosophize about, that art, you know, serves in our need as human beings. Yeah.
And so now, have you come to terms, if I may ask, with your shift? Because if you come from a place where culturally there are demands placed upon you, and I mean, you've shifted completely, if I understand mm-hmm. correctly, you mm-hmm. basically now dedicate your time full time to music and creation and performance artist as a musician, I guess that's the title. I mean, or how would you define yourself?
Yeah, I would consider myself a composer and a performer. Yeah. But I do feel, I do feel at ease with all of that and what that means. And I still love design. I still design a lot of, you know, things that have to do with my music. And I'm very influenced by that process. And I still love thinking in those terms. And when I come to a composition, for example, I feel like it's very similar, the process I go through as far as designing and generating ideas and looking at things different ways. You know, it's been a long process of coming to terms with this kind of role, this identity and this activity and purpose, but have absolutely no regrets and really, you know, love and I'm grateful that I can do this, however difficult it is.
Yeah. That's great. So can you share with us, because you say that you have a very particular way of approaching the work and when you compose?
Sure. I would say it varies a lot too. For example, I'll just talk about a couple of my processes. One work that we might also share some audio samples with would be The Unlearning, which are songs that I wrote between 2009 and 11 for a violinist and myself. And this is actually what I performed at YBCA when I met you. These were songs inspired by Goya's Disasters of War etchings.
Neat.
Speaking of, yeah, Spanish culture, which I'm still dying to see for, not the etchings I've seen, but to visit Spain and to see more of his work there. But in that process, I feel like the seed of it really was just this incredible sound that Carla Kilstead and I shared, the violinist, and she sings as well. And I was part of a project of hers before that. And when we got together to rehearse together, we just, you know, there's this incredible resonance between the two of us singing and playing our string instruments. And that was sort of this moment of inspiration that I really wanted to write something for the two of us. So it really comes that feeling from just sheer resonance and all the possibilities of what she can do as a vocalist and a violinist and what we can do together, sort of like a quartet, right? And then that process was about looking at Goya's etchings and just using that as a way to reflect on, at that time, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and how the violence of what was going on back in Goya's time was, you know, kind of still happening. Those really gruesome images and the injustice and the ridiculousness of the political situation. So the process of writing, you know, was sort of this circular, I guess you could say, like amalgam of both connecting visually. I feel like I'm a very visually oriented person, like looking at the etchings, sometimes being inspired just simply by the lines, the textures of these aqua tints. And then his titles are incredibly provocative. And so I actually use the titles of the etchings for the titles of the songs. And sometimes that would generate an idea for the text, as I also wrote the lyrics.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you have a narrative, if you actually write a narrative as well.
Yeah, it's not, that piece is not so much a narrative. It is a collection of about 21 songs. And so there's sort of a line that goes through it. But really, it's just sort of these haikus, as his etchings are. They're commentaries, they're miniatures on aspects of war and violence and questioning and reflection on that theme. And in the process of creating the music itself, a lot of it really, I would say, perhaps in all of my work, there's a commonality that my music comes out of playing and improvising. So I had a violin, I had my cello, I would just sing, I would play, I would experiment with things and record to kind of keep a sketchbook of techniques, you know, of sounds, of harmonies. And then I would start to try to, like, you know, hash them out, notate them, and then shape them and sculpt them on paper. But a lot of it comes out of just playing, you know, improvising and working with sound. I don't generally compose just on paper and hear everything in my mind. I have to hear things as I make them. So,
right. And do you think more rhythmically, or do you think more melodically or harmonically?
Oh, I would say all of those, and even including noise and texture and timbre as well. And the collection of songs really has all of those things. Yeah.
Right. I mean, for those out there in the universe that are not very familiar with your work, perhaps you want to give us a little bit of a sense, because the way I understand your work, perhaps I should say, is that it's very sonic in terms of finding certain sounds and certain vibrancies to the sound. I don't know if that's how you would define it for yourself, but there seems to be a research in the quality of resonance, in the shape of resonance, which to me is beautiful. And I don't know if that's something that you can relate with in terms of my, shall we say, tagging it of sorts.
Oh, I love the way you describe that. That's a great, it's fun to hear how others, you know, perceive what you're doing. And I think you kind of hit the point really clearly. I think you said shape of resonance and the kind of vibrancy of sound. And I think that's a great way to describe what I'm trying to get at. I really embrace all these aspects of what you mentioned earlier, whether it was rhythm or harmony or melody, and then noise and timbre. But I do feel at the heart of it is, like, I've also thought of it as like sensuality of sound. So this vibrancy, this any simple sound, whether you're singing a tone or you're playing a tone on an instrument, or you're creating a noise with an object. I just performed a piece last weekend with just objects from the audience. And there's just this quality of bringing to life something that might be very mundane or might be very sophisticated and, you know, trained as far as sound generation, but to go into that sound and how it moves you. And yeah, I think that is at the heart of a lot of my work and sort of what drew me to going back into music back in my design days was, you know, going to concerts where I experience improvisers, you know, working with the material of their instruments and being so completely moved by something that was really abstract, you know, didn't have necessarily any narrative. There was no composition, you know, previously conceived of, but just the pure sound that mysteriously can move you, you know, literally either to tears or in joy and to elevate the audience by this thing. It's It's very mysterious.
Can I ask, since you are very visually inclined, when you do present works, and I understand that you also work sometimes with your partner, are the performances very visually inclined? Are you also trying to bring your audience to have a visual experience?
Yes, I would say a lot of the time that's true. And then sometimes it's not that important. So on one hand, I've done pieces, for example, a string quartet I wrote for Del Sol, where I created a video, and the whole piece was sort of about the experience of sight, color in particular, color theory, gesture, and sound, and how those things are sort of perceived. I was trying to go back to the sense of how it felt before we had language, before we as people, for example, as babies could speak, what that might feel like to just be perceiving purely without words to describe what we are perceiving. And so that for that piece, you know, I was trying to connect just intonation, so tuning and frequency, with a video that I made of gestures of the face and the mouth, as well as the hands. And I was also walking around for part of the piece with a projector. And so that had a lot of visual quality to it that was sort of not intentionally addressing synesthesia, but sort of touching on the rims of, you know, what that feeling might be to experience all the senses fully. And I've done multimedia pieces with other visual components, with movement and video and costumes. But at the other end of the spectrum, I do really love just simply sitting down with other musicians and improvising, where, yeah, you can see us playing on stage, but that's not really that important. And, well, I guess it is in many ways. It's very interesting to see how people perform, but really the focus is on sound and listening in a very intent and focused way.
Do you think that we know how to listen today?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think listening is such an important part, such a key to so many things. And in my notes, when I'm working and practicing and composing, over and over and over, I keep writing, you know, listen more deeply, listen better, get more, you know, listen more. Just that quality and that practice. To go directly to your question, do you think we know how to listen today? Yes and no. I feel that it is evolving, let's say, in our world of contemporary music. You know, we've been influenced by people throughout the years, like John Cage and certainly Pauline Oliveros, who have really championed this idea of listening more, listening differently, and composers who challenge the way we listen to things, improvisers who invite us to experience listening in different ways. But in general, I feel that perhaps it's harder and harder to listen today because of the increase of information and noise and distraction and, you know, everything from social media to news to the inundation of, you know, the internet kind of going through all aspects of our lives. I think in general, it's more difficult to create space for listening. And you can even bring that further to, you know, creating time for people to listen to each other, time for people to have just nothingness, you know, space.
I absolutely agree with you. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just I being. Think that's kind of it. Just being. Mm-hmm. And just being, it is often connected with just listening and just observing and not having things, you know, stimuli entering you, but just simply being. And I think listening is one of the keys to how we can shape and transform not just ourselves, but, you know, our world around us, because it cultivates like a sense of connection, right? Obviously,
yeah, absolutely.
We connect with other people. We can connect with the plants. We can connect with animals. We can connect with our environment and our society if we are listening. So that's, I think that's a huge, huge area, yeah, of need, speaking as a designer.
Well, thanks for saying that and thanks for sharing. Would you like us to listen to one of your pieces with a certain intent in mind as we listen to some of your excerpts?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Or how should we listen? How should we open up to what you've created?
Oh, well, I guess as I would approach something new to me, I would just listen with an open mind and, you know, perhaps listen in a way that is most focused as possible, you know, whether, you know, through speakers or headphones or whatever, but just in a way that you're not doing a bunch of other things at the same time. Although I do that as well. I listen to the radio or podcasts or people's work when I'm, you know, doing things around the house. So yeah, I would just say keeping an open mind.
That sounds brilliant. Teresa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Maya. And I look forward to continuing our conversation.
That would be lovely. Be well.
Okay, likewise. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Let's segue now and listen to a couple pieces by Teresa Wong. We're going to start with an excerpt out of Mud Nest Signals. And this is for string quartet, voice, cello, and video. And that's going to be followed by Feline Pantomime, which was inspired by Goya's Disasters of War etchings. And this is performed by Teresa Wong on cello and voice, and Carla Kilstedt, violin and voice. We just heard Feline Pantomime from her release The Unlearning, which are 21 songs inspired by Goya's Disasters of War etchings. And that was preceded by Mud Nest Signals, which is actually an excerpt from a 20-minute piece. Thanks again for joining me for this edition of the Aeolian Impromptu. Tune in soon for some more conversations, music, and tidbits of contemporary classical music. Till then, be well.